You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a rainy, cool winter day. I can't say cold when it's above freezing because there's so many people in the country that are below.
55 degrees, at least at Sacramento Executive Airport right now. Here in Davis, it is very close to that. And this is February 11, 2026 for broadcast on February 12, 2026. And as I speak, the sun is pushing through the clouds out here in Solano County. The last measurable rainfall we had here in Davis was on January 5th. Just so you know, February 11th, January 5th. So 5 weeks without any rain whatsoever. We had just fallen a bit behind on terms of our average rainfall. Most of the storms and snow and whatnot that have hit the state in the month of January went around us almost entirely. And so we're a little behind here, but the snowpack is really the big issue for the state of California right now because it's very, very low. The day of the broadcast, Thursday, will be a high of 61 degrees with decreasing clouds. Thursday night, mostly clear, and then we'll have fog again. 41 degrees Thursday night. Friday will be 61 with patchy fog in the morning and then mostly sunny. Friday night, mostly cloudy, 43 degrees, and here we go into a slightly wetter pattern, even here, especially in other parts of California and all over the western states. Saturday will be 57 degrees and cloudy. Saturday night, a chance of rain as the first of a series of storms moves in. Sunday will just be rain, says the National Weather Service. Sunday, we will probably not get a lot of rain, but there will be showers mostly after 10 a.m. Sunday night, rain. Low around 43. Washington's birthday, Monday, rain, mostly cloudy with a high near 53. Monday night, rain, cloudy with a low around 42. And Tuesday, rain, mostly cloudy with a high near 52. Weather Underground is going out on a limb here. They're telling us we're going to get 3/4 of an inch of rain on Sunday, 1/2 inch on Monday, 1/3 of an inch on Tuesday, 1/4 of an inch on Wednesday, and a little tiny bit Thursday, Friday. The main point being showers. So it could be a lot of rain in one place and a lot less in other places. And temperatures staying above 40, except when we get to Tuesday, when it will be 36 degrees. And then Wednesday, 39 degrees. And then Thursday night, 38 degrees, and Friday, 35 degrees, possibly colder if it clears up that night. So we're still getting cold.
Those are the low temperatures, not the high.
Yeah, yes, thank you. Those are the low temperatures. The highs will be in the mid-50s each of those days. So, well, we're not, again, looking at any frost. It is still cold by our standards, and the soil is still cold. And so, of course, you know, the questions we're getting about...
It's not time to plant tomatoes,
is it? That is correct. It's not time to plant tomatoes yet. The questions we're getting about summer vegetables are couched in... What shall I be thinking about planting this year rather than I'm going to get out there and stick something in the ground right now? In fact, you still can plant cool season vegetables. This temperature range is great for leafy greens, lettuces, spinach, bok choy, although it will try and flower very quickly. So just harvest as fast as you can. We're still doing some of the leafy broccoli relatives like broccoli rabe, broccolini, things like that. We still have people planting peas, which will probably work out okay. Peas planted in early February grow rapidly, assuming they get past the white-crowned sparrows and other things that like to eat pea seedlings, and would be producing in late April, early May, when the weather is still suitable for one good harvest of peas. So it's kind of your last chance now in the month of February to plant Oh, all those leafy greens and things like that. Spinach, kale can still go in with no problem. Some of the brassicas, which is a term we use for all the members of the cabbage broccoli group, some of them will actually continue right on into the late spring and early summer in terms of leaves being harvestable, plants being harvestable. The flavor profile does change. They're not as sweet. They're not as crisp and tender. They get a little tougher as we get into warmer weather. But for folks who like them, you can actually continue harvesting. My experience with kale, for example, has been right on into the month of May. So you can continue planting those. And of course, it's time to start pivoting and thinking about the things that are going to go into your summer garden.
Next Wednesday, that's the 18th of February,
yep.
Warren Roberts is doing another Walk with Warren. Shields Gazebo, gather up there. They'll be walking around from noon until 1. Don, I want to make sure that our listeners again hear about the Great Backyard Bird Count because it's this weekend. So Friday the 13th and then through Monday, you've got 4 days to count whatever birds you see in your area or around the neighborhood or go to a park or what. Doesn't matter where you do it. You just write down where you are and then you write down what you can identify and how many of them you see at a time. And it's wonderful. It's easy, it's simple, and it is helpful for the scientists and the researchers to find out what's where, when.
Backyard bird count. This weekend.
Yes. And if you want to go to the website to sign in and register and find out more about how to do it and all stuff, birdcount.org is their official website.
Oh, there we go. Birdcount.org. Got it.
Yep.
There's a webinar coming up for how to preserve your surplus citrus. And this is being done by the UC Master Food Preservers. Winter Citrus Preserves event is February 25th from 7 to 8 p.m. This webinar does require registration, and you will learn how citrus becomes marmalade. You can learn safe methods, use different citrus varieties, troubleshooting tips, marmalade versatility, an overview of marmalade, why it's different from other preserves, research-based marmalade methods, including long boil and added pectin approaches, common marmalade challenges and how to address them, and ideas for using marmalade in everyday cooking. This free online class taught by the UC Master Food Preservers online delivery program focuses on food safety principles and practical techniques. And you'll learn how different varieties, oranges, lemons, grapefruit affect the flavor, the texture, the finished marmalade quality, and compares traditional marmalade methods with quicker approaches.
But Don, where did you find that event information?
UCANR.edu, one of our favorite sites, and just click on Events Yolo County, because there's hundreds of events all around the state. In Yolo County, this popped right up. February 25th, 7 to 8 p.m., how to make a marmalade. I speak as someone whose grandfather was not just a marmalade connoisseur. He was a very finicky marmalade connoisseur and felt that the only proper marmalade is made from the Seville orange, the sour orange that is traditionally used for marmalade. He, in fact, grew Seville orange at his house in Pasadena for the purpose of making marmalade. Seville orange is the most bitter flavored citrus that people grow intentionally. Let's put it that way. And a very, very high naringin content, which is what makes citrus, one of the things that makes citrus bitter. And that's considered part of the flavor, part of it boosts the other parts of the flavor. But of course, most of us go, ooh, bitter. We don't want that. Well, in citrus, a little bit of bitterness goes a long way. A lot of bitterness needs to be mitigated. So when you mitigate bitterness in Seville oranges, you do it with a lot of sugar, roughly equal parts sugar to fruit pulp. And it did make a rather remarkable marmalade. Once upon a time, we broke through his hardened prejudices on this and made marmalade from kumquats. And we gave that to him, and he allowed us how it was almost as good as Seville orange marmalade. So if you've got a bunch of kumquats out there, give them a try as well.
Do you know what strawberry boxes are? They're those. There's those things you buy strawberries in, and they're plastic, and they mostly holds with a few little straps holding them together. They are the perfect thing to put over your peas when they're young, because the air gets in, the sun will be fine. And once they get tall enough so they're touching the top of the box, well, they're probably too big to attract the white-crowned sparrows.
So something, a conversation I had with a gardener who works for older customers, and they're getting really frustrated, not just the sparrows, white-crowned sparrows are At least they're cute when they're eating your vegetables. But the tree squirrels, I guess they're marginally cute. Nobody really thinks tree rats are cute. They all come in and do damage. And they wanted to know some kind of solution to this that wouldn't be complicated. And they're older. They're in their 80s. And so they didn't want, you know, something heavy, or they're trying to build a building around their vegetable garden. Said, well, one of the simplest things you can do, anytime you're dealing with vertebrate pests, and that's the term we use for animals, birds, whatever, bigger things that come in and eat your plants, the only real answer you're going to find that works is physical barriers until the plants
exclusion.
Exclusion, yes. There's like four or five different things you learn about when you're trained on this. You can use poisons. Don't do that. You can use repellents. They don't work. You can have protectant animals. You have your own little yappy dog out there that chases them off. Well, tree rats eat, feed at night. And I can guarantee that white crowned sparrows don't care that much about your little yappy dog. What works
as long as you have your garden away from the bushes. And that's another one, exclusion by positioning.
Yes, make it harder for them to get at them. That's one of the first points I often try to make, is make it harder for them to get at the garden. But unfortunately, that's usually sort of locked in. Yeah. They built the garden next to the fence. Okay, well, that's actually not a good idea, as it turns out, with rodents, for example. So moving it further into the yard would be a better plan. Maybe use that box for rosemary and lavender and parsley and things like that, and have another box a little further out into the yard. But what really does work is wire mesh barriers. And the simplest is to go out and buy part of a roll of something sort of like chicken wire, but heavier duty. I usually use the same stuff that I use for lining holes for gophers. So it's a heavier gauge wire. It's very malleable. Two people wearing gloves, because they've got little sharp ends on the cut wire, can bend the sides and bend the end down until you've made essentially a dome. And you can plant your little seedlings or your little seeds and water it all in, and then set the dome over the whole bed. This works. Two people can do this quite readily. And then just leave it in place until the plants appear to be big enough for these pests to leave them alone, which in my experience with peas is about 6 to 8 inches. They need to get past the early germination stage. Don't let the plants grow through the wire mesh. That's the most important part of this whole project. Don't let them grow through, or else you'll have a real mess on your hands. I mean, they'll grow fine and yield fine, but you'll really regret it at the end of the season. So put it on there until the little seedlings are up high enough. Then the two of you can lift that off carefully and just set it off to the side to use on your next batch of seedlings. That works well for a lot of people. If you're still about to build your box, set the posts. First of all, move it forward. Move it further out into the garden. We know that that helps. Set the posts and leave them a bit higher than the box itself. One of my customers used 8-foot posts, had it all set. Usually they would cut them off at that point. Then he realized, you know, this is really a good opportunity. And he just fenced in the whole thing, taking the same kind of wire mesh, and just, you can, staple gun will do this. Then all you have to do, of course, is make an opening for yourself. And it should be something that's pretty easy to get in and out. But that is another way you can do it, is to just build it into the whole box itself. And of course, choosing a position that's a little further from their access points. But really just making a simple dome or cover of wire mesh seems to be the answer for a lot of people. I have had people try things like stakes with flashy tape on it. Well, that works pretty well, at least for a while.
For something.
Well, for the birds, especially, actually. If it's dancing in the breeze, it may tend to make them go elsewhere. One customer actually had went and got PVC, half-inch PVC. They had a raised planter box, so this is easy because you've got something you can attach fasteners to. Just essentially made a hoop over the box, and then we'll just cover that with what we call frost blanket, or sometimes called seedling blanket. And they would just pull that over and use clothespins to hold it in place until the little seedlings were established. That worked very well. And then that PVC is still in place next time in the season when you need to get some seedlings planted out there. So something that makes it easy to lift on and off the cover and just use a physical barrier. Yes, they can go under. Yes, they can go through. Yes, they can go around, but they don't want to. They certainly don't want to get trapped under that. That right there is one thing I can almost guarantee will keep them out, is that they don't want to be enclosed under something like that. They will not go someplace where they really have to work at it if there's something easier in your neighbor's yard. So that's the key, is to go past your garden to your neighbor's garden.
You know, because I think about these things sometimes, and boy, making a wire mesh dome, that sounds like a lot of work. But you know, I was at the dollar store the other day, and they had these, well, sort of sort of wastebaskets, but they were made out of mesh. Mm-hmm. So there was a solid bottom and then this metal, and it was maybe 10 or 12 inches tall. That would work just fine.
Yeah, just cover them.
Set it down and give it a little quarter turn, and it sinks into the soil, and you're done.
As long as
light's really easy, and you can stack them up. You could buy 20 of them or whatever.
As long as light gets in to the plant, that's mm-hmm. all that we care about. And the seedling and the seedling blanket and frost blanket, you know, they do reduce the light somewhat, but they actually function as little greenhouses. So if you happen to be planting summer vegetables, they actually give a little boost for that as well. So whatever is easy, I do find this wire mesh surprisingly easy to work with, and it folds and bends pretty well. You'll find like chicken wire is too light. It'll be a hassle. You need something a little heavier duty than that. And you need to have a place to stand it up and store it. Now, I've had people do something as simple as take tomato cages and put them over the plant. Let's say it's peas and they're going to climb up on something anyway. So they use the tomato cage. And while the little guys are getting established, they take frost blanket or whatever and just cover the whole thing. That works fine. But physical barriers.
Then you can leave that then in place the whole season. And I mean, not the frost blanket, but the
tomato cage. Yeah, and I have little doubt that any, you know, really determined tree rat or squirrel will find a way in there if they're really motivated. But generally speaking, they want to keep moving. This is the thing to remember. They don't want to be trapped. They want to keep moving. They don't want to be out in the open. And that goes for birds, mammals, you name it. Anyway, they can be very frustrating. Just figure out some way that you can cover them over if you possibly can. Strawberry baskets are one of the simplest things you can do. I had a problem many years ago. We were planting bean and squash and melon seeds would come home at the end of the day and they were gone. The seedlings had come up and then they were just either not even just gone. Sometimes they were pulled up and dropped on the ground, which was infuriating. And I could not figure out what was doing this, pulling out the seedlings as they were coming up, not even eating them, but leaving them present. Magpies were doing this. I came home in the middle of the day one day, looked out the window and saw them hopping down the row, pulling up one seedling after another and just dropping it in place.
Well, they were looking for the nuts, you know.
I don't know what their logic was, but it
if you pull up an oak seedling when it's really small, you get a nut, you get an acorn.
You may be giving them more credit for intelligence than they need, but they are magpies, and magpies are pretty clever birds.
They are, and they really like oaks. They like acorns. Okay, jays and magpies are acorn birds.
And so I would just take those strawberry baskets you were talking about, stick the seed in the ground, water it, stick the strawberry basket upside down over it, and wait until the seedling was pushing against the basket before I'd remove it. That worked each time.
And our first email message is from Annie in San Rafael. And she writes, "Greetings, Don and Lois, my amazing garden gurus. I would love your help again in Sunset Zone 16. I have a Meyer lemon tree that is in its second winter. It hasn't grown since I planted it this summer before last. I planted other plants around it, and I believe I'm watering it properly. The neighboring plants are getting watered several times a week, and this tree is being watered twice a week. Nothing has changed since it started raining. I have fed it organic citrus food. It's planted in an area that used to be occupied by a live oak, which was on the fence line. We removed that because it was tilting due to our neighbor's frequent watering of their nearby palm trees.
Okay.
Do you think that leftover chemicals from the live oak roots might have anything to do with a lack of my lemon tree thriving?
Okay, let's take these questions one at a time. There's no chemicals left over from the roots of the tree. What you would have is nitrogen immobilization due to the breakdown of the roots, and that wouldn't be evenly distributed. So what people are referring to in this situation is that when you turn any kind of cellulose into the soil, whether it's just by killing a tree and leaving its roots to decay or turning in wood chips or things like that, you know, if they cut down a tree and incorporate the grindings, it's going to be hard to grow something in that area for a little while as the cellulose basically ties up all the nitrogen and some of the sulfur and some of the calcium, some other ingredients that are in the root zone in the process of decaying. Now, eventually it will release those back to whatever roots are growing into that area, but it can take a while. It can cause problems with tree growth or plant growth for a couple of years. I had a customer who had a tree cut down, had it all ground out, and didn't get in touch with us about what to do next after ordering their 15-gallon ginkgo. Ginkgo was delivered, ginkgo was planted, and 2 years later, it had grown a matter of about 3 inches. Ginkgos are slow-growing trees. but not that slow growing. And it looked fine. It just looked pretty much like when she had planted it. And she was a little disappointed in that rate of growth. Part of it was that probably 50% of what soil zone it was going into was just turned in shavings from having ground up the stump and the tree that had been there before. I said, well, you have a problem, which is the tree simply can't access nitrogen. That, you know, what's in the soil is not available to it. So my only suggestion in that situation is to take a liquid fertilizer that you know you can get right down into the root zone by putting it on with enough water to fully get it into the root zone of what you imagine it to be for this tree, and start feeding it, let's say, once a month. Any soluble fertilizer will be fine. It doesn't have to be citrus food. It could be houseplant food for all I care. You're mainly after nitrogen. Follow the label directions. Start doing that at the beginning of the growing season. Start feeding with that. Worked for her ginkgo, and I suspect it will probably work for your citrus. What you have from this picture is some plants around this tree that look very healthy. They look like lantana or something like that. They're doing fine, so they're not showing any particular nitrogen deficiency. But if there is a nitrogen deficiency in the region due to the roots of the tree decaying or whatever, you can mitigate that with a light soluble fertilizer that gets to the roots, and it won't hurt to do this. So when you're putting a dry citrus food on the ground and there's a lot of bark there and there's other plants nearby that are relatively shallow rooted, I don't know how much of that citrus food is getting to your citrus tree. So I want you to focus on getting nitrogen to the root zone of the young tree. And I have this conversation with people about young citrus a lot. First of all, they can be slow to get going. They just, the roots often kind of fall apart as we're planting them. They tend to have fairly fragile root systems. There's almost a 3 to 6 month period in many cases of just reestablishing the roots where they barely grow. But within the first year, you should get a foot or two of growth, and you're not getting that. So if the roots are struggling to establish, it sounds like you're watering correctly. The thing you can augment is the nitrogen. And putting dry nitrogen on the surface in this instance is fine, but probably not getting it where it needs to get. So go buy your favorite liquid plant food. Fish emulsion is great. Whatever your local garden center is, probably have their own favorite soluble fertilizer. I don't really care that much what the three numbers are in this instance. It's the first number I'm concerned about. I'd like it to be at least 10% nitrogen. More than that is fine. And follow the label directions. Mix up about 2 to 3 gallons worth of it and water all at once with that 2 to 3 gallons worth of mixed up fertilizer solution. Do that once a month. You should start getting new growth on it. And you should get on a Meyer lemon 1 to 2 feet of growth each year. In general, if your citrus are not growing 1 to 2 feet of growth each year, you probably need to give them some nitrogen. You'll find recommendations for citrus feeding that are all over the place. I once sat down and spent an evening cross-referencing different recommendations for citrus fertilization programs from legitimate EDU sites, citrus research stations, popular media, and there was no consistency whatsoever in what people were recommending, except give them nitrogen on a regular basis seemed to be the consistent theme. I would say feeding earlier in the season is actually better than feeding late in the season, especially if you're in a coastal climate where you're dealing with the citrus leaf miner causing a lot of damage to the plant, because we know that that particular pest oviposits only in tender new growth and primarily in the late summer. So reducing the amount of tender new growth in the late summer will reduce the harm from the citrus leaf miner. So feeding March, April, maybe early May will get your growth early, surge in the spring, early summer, get those leaves hardened up, get that nice waxy leaf coating on them as we get into later into the summer, and it'll reduce the available ovipositing sites for the citrus leaf miner. Other than that, there's not a real concern with feeding citrus almost any time of year. I remember long ago having a conversation with the owner of Four Winds Growers, one of the premier citrus growers here on the West Coast. This is Don Dillon Sr., for any of you who know Four Winds Growers. And I was asking him about their feeding schedule. He said, oh, we feed them every month. I said, what, year round? He goes, yeah, every month, year round. We feed them with some good fertilizer. He told me what it was. It was a commercial fertilizer that also had trace elements in it. I said, so you feed in the winter, going into the winter? Oh yeah, we feed December, January, whatever. I said, well, what about stimulating new growth, you know, tender new growth going into freezing weather? He goes, yeah, so? I said, well, I mean, we've always been told you shouldn't stimulate new growth going into the winter. It can be damaged by freezing weather. I said, as far as we're concerned, a healthy, vigorous tree will come back from frost damage better than a nitrogen deficient tree. So that was his logic. This was before the citrus leaf miner had come into California. There's nothing wrong with feeding almost any time. The only caveat would be that if you feed early to midsummer or even later in the season, you're stimulating growth at a time when it may be more injured by that particular pest. But if your tree is yellow, there's nothing wrong with giving it some nitrogen. And if it's not growing 1 to 2 feet a year, you definitely should give it some nitrogen effectively into the root zone. So this is why I would shift over to a liquid form if that would be something you can implement. I'd also look at the placement of these lantanas. Pretty darn close to the tree. And I wonder if they're crowding it a little bit. I think they're lantanas looking at them. Can't quite tell. But if they're perennial plants with strong root systems that close to a young citrus like this, they might be competing with it and getting more benefit from that citrus food than the tree is getting. So you might think about moving them a little further away from the tree so that they're just not competing with the young tree. Later on, it'll be fine if they grow in there, but you need to get this tree getting some new growth on it.
And those little plants are small enough that moving them is going to be a piece of cake.
Yeah, if they're lantanas, they won't hurt them at all. I can't tell for sure, but that's sure what they look like from here.
So we have a question from Annie in San Rafael. My question has to do with a podcast earlier this year. You mentioned pruning the fruiting spurs of apricots. Ah. We had a spectacular crop of my wonderful 5-year-old Blenheim apricot last summer. Cool. I would do anything to replicate that. They were so, so yummy. Would you please provide detailed instructions on how and when to prune those apricot spurs?
Okay, that's an important thing because I don't want you pruning out the spurs of apricots. I want you to prune to renew the spurs of apricots. And it may be that I didn't make that real clear. First of all, the only apricot variety I sell at my nursery at this point is Blenheim. I mean, I used to stock other varieties, and Blenheim would all sell out first, and then whatever I had left over would finally sell. There are some other good apricot varieties out there, but it has such an amazing flavor. It's such a classic Northern California variety. I mean, it was the mainstay of our apricot industry back when we had one here in California. It was the classic for that purpose. It doesn't have the perfect market characteristics of modern apricots. It tastes a lot better than they do. I absolutely guarantee it. So if you ever have the opportunity to grow an apricot, Blenheim is the one I would recommend. And it is the only one, at this point, as I say, it's the only one I sell at my nursery at this point. The problem with apricots in pruning them, aside from the fact that we don't do it in the winter, really important. We don't do apricot pruning in the rainy season. We only prune them in the summer because of a risk of a disease getting in through the pruning wounds. So I want to get that out there first. Apricots fruit on spurs, or old wood as we call it. The spurs form on about the third year and they last for 4 or 5 years. And so you, unlike apple spurs or cherry spurs, which can last for 20, 30 years or more, apricot spurs will slowly die out at the level that they form at. And if you don't do pruning for size control on your apricot tree, gradually your apricots will just be higher and higher on the tree. Now they're a big, beautiful tree. If you ever have a place where you can grow an apricot as a, you know, as almost as a shade tree, they have a lovely spreading habit. They're beautiful when they're in bloom. They're actually one of the most ornamental of the stone fruits. But at that point, a lot of your fruit is going to have to be picked from a ladder or a fruit picker. You don't want it falling to the ground because it's a very soft fruit. In the case of Blenheim, we do pick it while it's still firm because they soften very quickly once they get going. So you want to be able to walk up to the tree, get up on a short ladder at most, and pick the fruit. So you're going to prune for size control, but you're also going to prune, thinning the tree carefully to get more light to the inside, to get more branches to grow, break and grow, buds to break, branches to grow somewhat on the interior to form new spurs, because you're going to need to thin out the branches where the spurs have aged out. So starting in about the 5th or 6th year, you need to prune for renewal of spurs. Renewal means you need to make growth that will have new spurs forming on it as your older spurs are dwindling out. I hope that's clear, because hard pruning on apricots can significantly reduce fruit production. If you don't prune them, all the fruit gets out of reach over time. So it's just, you just have to drop the height of it down, allow some new branches to grow to replace old branches, much more so than we do with other stone fruits, because it's really important to renew those spurs over time. That's really the key thing I was getting at. Removing the spurs themselves. No, we don't do that. They kind of do that themselves. But it's the renewal of the wood that will have the spurs that's the important consideration.
So she had a wonderful crop last yep. year. I mean, to my mind, it would be, don't touch that tree.
Well, you can
let it give you fruit for another year before you know.
An important consideration is that apricots are alternate bearing, And so if you had a wonderful large crop last year, there's a high likelihood you'll have a light crop this coming year. They tend to go back and forth, as do certain other trees. Persimmons are known for this. Pecans are known for it. Mandarins are known for it. Alternate bearing is a real phenomenon. But be aware that because you had a large crop, you're likely to have a smaller crop this year.
What do I remove in order to start this process of spur removal? And do I remove it down to the main trunk? I mean, the main branch?
You're remembering that spurs last 4 to 5 years. You're taking out wood that is 6 to 7 years old. So this is down the road a ways after you've planted it. And you're taking that out in a place where there's a nice new branch coming up that's maybe 1 to 2 inches in diameter that can replace that.
Also, so you wait until you have a branch that you can cut back to.
You do if you can, yes. Now, I have to say, we had a lot of questions about training and pruning fruit trees here in the last couple of weeks. For a number of years, my nursery offered a fruit tree pruning service. We, for 20 years plus, and we had 80, 90, almost 100 customers where we would go between December and February and we'd prune their fruit trees. And we learned a couple of things. One is that they don't follow the textbook. The fruit trees don't look like those cool diagrams that are in your How to Prune a Fruit Tree book. They've often been trained in, let's just say, unusual ways, sometimes very strange. And very commonly, I would say, I would just guess more than half the time, part of what we were doing was what you would call corrective pruning, because people had gone out, for example, and just stubbed back the tree at some point. They wanted to control the size, so they just headed it. If you happen to have to do that, and you may have to do that on something like an apricot to try and get some renewal wood going, be aware, the point to which you cut, there will be 3 or 4 buds there that will now be freed from their constraints from the hormones that were coming down from the top of that branch, and they will suddenly all break and grow that this coming season. So you'll have this old proliferation.
Quadruplets.
Yes. The term that was used when I took pomology was panic growth. It's the plant responding to major injury with panic growth. A bunch of shoots are going to come out to replace that. All of them attached right about the same location, and none of them particularly well attached. And so we would see this situation sometimes when we'd been hired to come in and prune after, say, the spouse had done it for a few years, and now it was our job to clean up their mess. And we would say, okay, this is going to be a 2-year process. There's 6 shoots coming out here. We want to conserve a couple of them, but we don't want to leave all this stuff here. So we're going to take half of this out this year, and we're going to head back the others to some degree, just for size control and to reduce the possibility of splitting. Monitor that. Possibility it'll break, but probably not, because there's not much fruiting wood on there yet. Then next year, we're going to thin this out some more. In other words, it's a 2-step process. Sometimes you have to make a heading cut. Yeah, especially with a fruit tree where someone's already done so. In general, with pruning, we don't like heading cuts at all. A heading cut is when you just cut it off wherever it is without any growth there, no branch there to choose. You're just cutting it off like a hedge. So you're doing a heading cut. The consequences of heading cuts are very predictable. Multiple shoots coming out poorly attached. You want to choose the best 1 or 2 and hope they're well attached and monitor them over time, because they're going to be replacing all that stuff that you cut back, and you want them well positioned. Bearing in mind that fruit trees are also much more heavily pruned than ornamental or shade trees. And so if there's a problem down the road, you can correct it. Okay, this is not like a big mistake on a big maple tree where someone does a terrible heading cut. That can become a structural issue that's unsafe down the road. It's not an issue with fruit trees. It's just a matter of keeping them in balance, reducing fruit load, and reducing the likelihood of breaking in a manner that's going to be dangerous to the tree in the long run. So you want to balance the growth of the tree against your needs for keeping the fruit within picking range, spraying it. If you're using a spray rig of some sort, you want to be able to get good coverage on the tree, and coming in the summer to do further pruning on it, preferably from the ground or a short ladder. So size control, fruit management, harvest operations are important goals of the home gardener that are not exactly in alignment with what fruit orchard operators would be doing. They have a totally different goal. They want 1,000 peaches on a peach tree. You want 100. Okay. And you're going to prune accordingly. Most deciduous fruit trees will grow in the spring. They'll flower, they'll set fruit, and they put all their growth is done by July. and into August. And if you cut them back before they're done with that growth, they'll resprout right away. But if you wait until they've finished with that growth and go into what my pomology professor called the quiescent period, they will not. So this is why summer pruning has become adopted by a lot of home gardeners for size control. You get all that growth out of the way, you got all the fruit, you're done harvesting. Now you got to see what you got. And if you prune them back at that point, August, September, which is the only time you should be pruning your apricot, you will not stimulate new growth right away. In the case of apricots, you do it all in the late summer or early fall, well before the rainy season, because of the risk of Eutypa disease getting into the cut pruning wounds. We know that's a big problem. And so about 10 or 15 years now, we've all been recommending not pruning apricots or cherries during the rainy season. And this, keep in mind that apricots are a little unique and that you need to renew the spurs. The spurs are very visible. It's very obvious where they are. And you can watch as time goes by, as they just sort of finish up, you're only getting one or two apricots where the spur used to produce five or six, then that is beginning to decline. And you just need to make sure new healthy spurs are forming elsewhere on the tree, preferably within picking range. I will say one case where I think vase training is okay, or, you know, I'm not a big fan of it because I think it has issues with long-term structural stability of the tree. And so apricots are one case where it really is popular and works well. So a lot of people do take them at the time of planting, head them back to about 3 feet, train 2 to 3 or 4 well-positioned scaffold branches, try to have them distributed up and down the trunk a little bit further from each other than the common scenario I see where they're all coming out at one point. Better distribution can make a big difference. But with the spreading habit of the tree, some careful training, a vase-trained apricot can actually be a very manageable size and format. And it's not such heavy fruit that I'm as concerned with an apricot as I am with, say, a peach or a nectarine about a heavy fruit load causing an entire scaffold branch to go breaking out and tearing down the main trunk. That's one of my main issues with vase training, is that if you use it on a peach or a nectarine or a larger fruited type, the risk of limb breakage is probably, it's not only increased, it does more damage to the tree in the long run because of the way it breaks. Apricots, that's less of an issue. So you might look into vase training or open center training for your apricot tree.
Well, Don did it again. He sent me pictures.
Yeah.
And the first one, oh my goodness, Don, those white flowers are just spectacular. So I looked at this picture and I said, all right, there are 5 petals and they're kind of spaced out from each other. So it's like they're floating in the air.
Separated, really, yes.
But I'm looking at that and thinking 5 petals. Well, now what fruit do I know that has 5s in it? And if you cut an apple crosswise and you look at it, hey, it's got 5 things. So my guess is apple blossoms.
Well, the only apple that I have that's even close to bloom is the very, very early blooming Anna apple. These are pears. Pears are blooming.
That's related.
It's related to apples. It's in the pom group of the rose family. So apples and pears and quince and loquats and pyracanthus are all in that tribe within the rose family, which means that they share one, the fruit all looks pretty similar. If you look closely at it, you'll begin to realize, look at a pyracantha berry sometimes. It looks like a little tiny apple. Pears are the earliest blooming in that crowd, particularly the non-fruiting pears. Locally, we have a group of young people who go out and take videos around Davis, My Davis, I think it's called. They do a great job. And they happen to do a video of pear trees in bloom because the pear trees in downtown Davis are in full bloom. And they noticed, as many people do, the rather funky odor of the flowers of pear trees. It's not particularly pleasant. And they thought that these were Bradford pears, which are planted downtown, but aren't actually blooming yet, at least as we speak. So I thought I'd clear this up a little bit. Part of our annual, what's that tree? Segment of the Davis Garden Show. The first trees blooming typically are Pyrus kawakami, sometimes sold as the evergreen pear. Let me see what common name the Western Garden Book put on Pyrus kawakami. Evergreen pear is the name I knew it as in Southern California because it wouldn't always drop its leaves down there. They say evergreen pear. Okay, so Pyrus kawakami is often blooming here in December. It appears to have no chilling hours requirement as far as we can tell. If any, maybe 50 hours, who knows? Usually it's blooming in December and into January and coming into full bloom about now. This year, that early bloom was very much delayed because we had 5 weeks straight of extremely cold, foggy weather. So they just didn't develop their flower buds. And now they're in full bloom. They are one of the first trees to bloom in the area. They bloom with the almonds, which are beginning to bloom around the countryside out in the orchards. And they are very pretty when they're in bloom. Bright white, clouds and clouds of flowers, and it is not Bradford pear. And the reason this is important is that Bradford pear is a very problematic tree. It's a cultivar of Pyrus calariana, different species. Remember, the other one is Pyrus kawakami. Pyrus calariana was heavily planted in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and into the 1980s. We opened in the early 1980s, 1981 at Redwood Barn Nursery, and already the problems with it were becoming apparent. Our industry magazines, remember them? Our industry publications were describing how these were falling apart during ice storms back east, how the branch splitting was a big problem, how fire blight disease was attacking the Bradford pear, how the fruit litter could be a nuisance, and how mistletoe could be a problem. And so in the first years we were in business, a whole bunch of new cultivars of Pyrus calariana came on the market. Aristocrat, Chanticleer, Cleveland Select, Red Spire, Trinity, Capital. I can remember all of those, each one being introduced as being an improvement on the Bradford pear, one way or another. Better branch angles, less fruit, and so on. All of them were problematic. Nothing in the species Pyrus calariana should be planted anywhere. That's a nice, simple declarative statement. It should not be recommended, should not be grown, should not be planted. Curiously, I still see them on wholesalers' growers' lists, so somewhere they're selling them, but I can't imagine where, because it's pretty well known now that calariana pears are very problematic. In the East Coast, where it rains in the summer and they can get their young seedlings established, they become highly invasive, and the seedlings of Pyrus calariana are covering whole areas, and they're thorny, and it's just a nightmare. Out here, the biggest issue has typically been branch structure, so that the branches just crash out of them. They come splitting apart, not just in storms, pretty much any time. And several of them had soft fruit, aristocrat pear, and were very attractive to birds. Oh, cool, except that the birds would bring mistletoe. Oh, no. So they would have mistletoe, and they'd get pruned, which would make things even worse. So fire blight is just another problem with them that has been an issue as well. They'll be blooming in a couple weeks. Very first blooms on the Bradford pears. Let's not blame Pyrus kawakami for the problems that Bradford pear has. Kawakami is actually a nice tree. No, I don't sell it or recommend it for a couple of reasons, but it doesn't fall apart. It doesn't get the fire blight that badly. It gets it in a much more manageable way. It doesn't have the bad structure issues that all the calariana pears had. And it has this really interesting habit of blooming midwinter. So it's the very first of the trees to bloom. That's Pyrus kawakami, sometimes called evergreen pear, because in most parts of California, the leaves hang on through the winter. They may even turn kind of a nice color, but they typically hang on through the winter all the way until the new growth begins in the spring. That's the first of the trees that's blooming.
And I'm assuming this row of white flowered trees is the same. The picture you sent me that is out in the field someplace?
That is in my orchard, and those are plums. So the plum trees are beginning to bloom. My plums, I have plums and pluots, and the very first of them are either beginning to bloom, or in the case of the picture I sent you, have come into full bloom already. So some of the white flower trees you're seeing out there, especially if they're in, you know, family orchards, could well be plums. My Santa Rosa tree plum is just coming into bloom. The picture I sent you is another variety that's in full bloom right now. So what this means, One relevance of this is that nurseries are going to be potting up their bare root fruit trees, that whatever they have left over, really quickly, because they're beginning to break dormancy and they'll be getting into pots if they aren't already. So bare root fruit tree buying season is winding down very rapidly at about the same time it usually does. But the plums are the very first to bloom. Plums and pluots and apricots are the first of the fruit trees to bloom. They bloom with the almonds, which are already coming into bloom in this area.
Oh, you said your plum tree is blooming. Let me look out the... Oh, there's a flower on my plum tree, Don.
There you go.
I see buds, and one of them is starting to break. It's not open yet, but Wow.
Yeah, and one of my...
Thank you for telling me that.
One of my early peaches is already pushing color. This becomes important for folks who are wanting to spray for peach leaf curl. If it's showing any color, it's too late. And we've got rain coming in for the next week. So my guess is if you haven't already sprayed for peach leaf curl in this area, probably too late to do so, because by the time we'll have spraying weather again, they'll be in full bloom. So that needs to be done before the buds show any green or flower color. And that's where we are at this point with some varieties, not all of them, but some varieties.
And the third picture he sent me is this lovely, very soft pink. The branches have no leaves or anything, but It's covered with these lush pink flowers.
If you zoom in closer, you'll see they're semi-double pink flowers as opposed to a single row of petals.
Right.
This is the Prunus blyriana. usually sold as flowering plum, not the red leaf plum. That'll be a little bit later, which has very pretty flowers as well. The red leaf plum or purple leaf plum, those are Prunus sericifera. Bleriana is a hybrid between two species, so it is sterile. It does not fruit. Very important characteristic. If you're planting a plum for its flowers and you don't want to mess, look for Prunus bleriana, and it blooms very, very early. There's a number of them around town. It's one of the few flowering trees that I can really recommend in our area. Seems to take the heat reasonably well. Not super drought tolerant, but okay with drought if it comes to that. Manageable size, 15 to 20 feet, very prunable, and not not a mess. You don't get the fruit litter that you get from a lot of the red leaf plums. The other flowering plum that I do sell, it's a red leaf type, is the purple pony, which has red leaves, smaller flowers, and it is fruitless. It has never fruited since it was introduced in 1962, so we hope it's not about to start. So those two are reasonable. The red leaf plums can be a big mess. Crouter Vesuvius, which will be blooming in about 2 weeks, is the most popular red leaf plum. It has very light fruit crops usually, is how I've taken to saying this.
Usually, yeah.
No, light crops, usually. Sometimes heavier crops, sorry to say. But it's a nice red leaf plum if you really want that purple-red color. But this Prunus bleriana is the one that you're seeing blooming right now, various parts of town, and actually does quite well in our area. The other thing that someone sent me a picture of is a Prunus campanulata, which is a type of flowering cherry that blooms very early. There's one in El Macero, on South El Macero Drive, very pretty tree, and there's a couple of them here and there around town. Campanulata refers to the fact that its flowers are the shape of campanula flowers, or bell flowers, and they hang, so it's actually very lovely. In little clusters, they have spurs for flowering, and they don't set fruit, as far as I can tell, and they dark red, burgundy, that's the color I'm looking for, burgundy red flowers, very showy, and they start blooming in late January, early February. A few of them around town, and the flowering apricot, which is sometimes called flowering plum, to be very confusing, Prunus mumi, those were blooming mid-January. There's at least one in the arboretum and a couple around town that people have noticed as well. But the things you're really seeing now are the flowering plums and the Kawakami pears.
So we had a writer who wrote in, this is Nancy, doesn't say where she lives. She says, I have several patches of Italian arum in my yard. Mm-hmm. How can I get rid of it? I've read things online that say, dig it out. Don't dig it out. Roundup works on it. Nah, Roundup doesn't work on it at all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So thanks for any help and advice.
Italian arum, arum italicum pictum is the plant in question. And my grandmother called them lords and ladies. I'm not sure where that name came from, but it's... as the name tells you, arum, it's in the Araceae. It's in the family of calla lilies. And when it flowers, you'll see the relationship. Everything in that family, the flowers all have that characteristic calla lily structure to them. I assume that the Italian arum was sold by bulb suppliers 70, 80 years ago. That's the only way I can assume it got to California. And my grandparents were in Pasadena. It was in their yard there. That house had been built in the beginning of the 20th century. And these things were there when they bought it, and they could not get rid of them. It's on my property. It was planted, obviously, right near the front of the house. Someone put it in intentionally. And yes, you can try and dig it out. It isn't likely to work. And no common herbicides, including glyphosate or any of the newer iterations of Roundup, do not seem to kill it either. It's a very persistent plant. I think those don't work because it has a very waxy leaf coating. And so a lot of plants, when people try to spray them with common herbicides, will find that like ivy, Italian arum, things like this, it's a waxy leaf coating. You can watch as the spray just sort of balls up on the leaf and falls on the ground. And that's not how those materials are absorbed. So it just plain doesn't work on them. I have not yet found, personally, anything that kills this plant. For those of you who don't know what it is, why it might have been planted intentionally, the leaf looks like a calla lily leaf, so it's pretty. It's an attractive leaf. The variety Pictum, which is the most common apparently, has a variegation pattern where the veins are a slightly different color than the darker green leaf, so that's kind of attractive. It puts out this flower that looks like a rather boring pale green calla lily, which is then followed by, and I have to assume this was the main selling feature once upon a time, bright orange, shiny fruit that look like a
vertical on a stalk.
Yeah, they look like a cob of corn.
Like a lollipop.
Right. And they are very shiny and very attractive. And I can tell you, as someone who once had a toddler boy, they're very attractive and they're also very poisonous. And so you know, if you happen to have this plant in your yard, it is in RAC, members of RAC vary quite a bit as to the presence of these toxins in the leaves and the stems and the fruit and whatnot. Diefenbachia is a good example of one that you'll definitely be seeing your doctor if you bite into it. Others like golden pothos contain the same thing, but in such minute quantities that you would have to eat a ton of them before you get any kind of adverse reaction. The fruit on this is very poisonous. So when we had toddlers, and these things were on the property and we couldn't get rid of them, we made a point, as soon as the flowers had come up and finished their thing, we would chop the flowers off just so we wouldn't have this shiny, attractive, poisonous fruit right near the front door. I didn't ever find anything other than persistently digging them out that actually worked. And that would be a 2 to 3 year process where you would have them. You would dig them all out. The bulbs are pretty obvious, but it's hard to get every single one of them. They'd come up again the next year. You dig those out. And over a 2 to 3 year period where I didn't want them in a particular garden bed, I was able to dig them out. But it's not a one-time thing. You're going to have to keep after them, that's for sure. And again, I don't think any herbicide is likely to work on them. Smothering them would probably work, except those bulbs can hang out in the soil for a very long time. I suppose you could smother them with 8 to 10 inches of arborist wood chips. That might work, and just, you know, chop off or bury every leaf as it pushes through. In general, smothering is our best approach to very difficult perennial weeds, and this is definitely in the category of a very difficult perennial weed. So in my case, I've just sort of planted around them. They get about a foot tall, so I make sure any perennial in that area is taller than they are, or I use ground covers like Campanula porcharesquiana, which grow around them and look very nice with them, and I just basically have learned to live with them. It's going to be hard to get rid of, but no, chemicals don't work. Digging does up to a point, but you got to be persistent.
So if you don't have wood chips and this just, you know, this thing popping up out of the soil, mm-hmm. If I took a hoe and I hoed off the leaves when I saw them, and then, you know, when they came back a couple of weeks later, I hoed off the weeds, mm-hmm. would that starve them?
If you did that for 3 to 5 years, yeah.
3 to 5 years? Don, I don't think I can be doing that
one, lady. Pay someone else to do it. Yeah, there you go. You know, the thing is, it's not going to become a huge problem unless you let those fruit ripen and then it'll reseed itself. So when seedlings would come up, I found them pretty easy to get out. They're pretty recognizable when they first come up. The bulbs themselves are pretty deep down there and you have to be persistent.
This looks like it should be a house plant. Would this be a house
plant? What a great idea. Here we go. I think we're on to something here. And, you know, 90% of the house plants you buy are in this plant family. I wouldn't be surprised if you could grow this one as a house plant. Shall we start a new trend? Davis Garden Show recommending Italian arum indoors. Highly poisonous.
By the way, the flower inflorescence on this thing is what's called a spade and spathula.
Yes. And all calla lilies have that. So members of RAC,
kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good, very familiar one back east. All the callas are very familiar. Some have never been known to flower. Golden pothos is in that family, and as far as I know, has never been known to flower. So many of them are vegetatively propagated, but the flowers of some are quite showy. This one is just intermittently showy. Now, in the tangential category of invasive plants that were probably intentionally planted once upon a time, someone came into my store looking for sorrel. Now, when they say sorrel, they could mean any of a number of things. I had one customer looking for sorrel who wanted to make cream of sorrel soup, you know, use it for cooking. That's sorrel, which is sold in the herb section of your garden center. We brought some in. She was very happy. That's not one of these at all. Wood sorrel is a common name for members of the genus Oxalis. Not for all members. There are hundreds of species in the genus Oxalis, but the yellow-flowered weed that is probably the most invasive plant in California and many other Mediterranean regions. The yellow Bermuda buttercup is a common name that's put on it. It's not from Bermuda. It's not a buttercup, so why not? Bermuda buttercup is Oxalis pes capra, and this was actually what he was looking for. And I said, well, any nursery that sells that should have their license revoked. So be careful with your common names. Wood sorrel does refer to any of a number of members of the genus Oxalis, most of which are not invasive, a few of which are potentially or somewhat invasive, and one of which is, as I said, probably the most invasive plant. Okay, mustard is more invasive, oats are more invasive, but it's getting up there because there are whole hillsides covered with this plant. And it's one of those things where you wish you didn't know about it when you see a hillside covered with it. You wish you just could go, what a beautiful hillside. Look at those lovely yellow flowers. It's so pretty. It's like the mustard. But if you're a plant person and you know anything about the ecology, all you're doing is standing there with your arms folded going, it's a terribly invasive plant. We shouldn't be admiring the flowers. Just don't plant it intentionally. That'd be a good starting point. Okay, we got a message from Jenny a few weeks back about pruning and training of young fruit trees that she was planting close together, and some great pictures, by the way, of how this was done. You know, three trees in one hole, two trees in one hole, all that kind of thing, and whether or not to use open or vase training or modified central leader training, and any other quick pointers. When you're planting fruit trees very close together, high density spacing. If you take three trees, like a couple of your pictures, two or three trees planted very close, 2 to 3 feet apart in a hole, 3 or 4 feet apart in a triangle, something like that, you're training and pruning them in the future as if they're a single tree. It's real important that you not let one dominate the other, which will happen almost no matter what if you don't manage them carefully for this purpose. So even though they may be, you know, all apples, all on the same rootstock, you might be surprised to learn that, say, Golden Delicious is more vigorous than Fuji. As you manage these for the next 15 to 20 years, that you don't allow any one of them to overtake the others. I consider modified central leader training to be probably your best approach to multiple trees in very close spacing, because it gives you more to work with in terms of placement of the branches. You need to train them so the branches are not crossing each other, not going to the inside of this grouping of trees, just as you would train a tree not to have branches going to the inside of its own scaffold. So your summer pruning is used for size control and shaping. And so if one of them is growing bigger than the others, prune it back a bit harder in the summer to keep them all relatively in balance size-wise. So placement of the branches is going to be your important decision over the first 2 to 3 years, size control over the next 5 to 10 years. Why would you do this kind of planting? Because you can get a lot more varieties into a small space. So the reason for three in one hole, the reason for multi-graft fruit trees, the reason for high density backyard orchard placement is to get more different types of trees. Each one is producing a lot less than it would if you let it grow to its full potential, but you want to get a lot more different types of trees in one area. You want an early peach like Gold Dust, a mid-season peach like Laurel, and a late peach like O'Henry, and you've only got room for one peach tree, well, you plant them all together in one area, preferably on the same rootstock, so they're all comparable in their growth habit, and then you prune them so no one crowds out the others. That's the main purpose of this kind of high-density planting. One of the most effective things I've seen is using fruit trees as a hedge. Now, Chuck Ingles, who's we've mentioned a few times, who was really involved in the Fair Oaks Community Garden and a lot of these topics, he liked to refer to fruit trees after summer pruning as fruit bushes. And I have a picture he gave me years ago of how he had pruned their pluots at the end of the summer, brought them down 3 to 4 feet. And I said, it looks like a hedge. I mean, he didn't literally hedge prune it, but it looks like a hedge. And it gave great privacy between him and the neighbors. Neighbors loved the fruit hanging over the fence. There wasn't so much that it was a nuisance. So he was pruning his fruit trees like fruit bushes. And that's fine. I have to say that a lot of people are managing fruit trees in a manner that is not ultimately sustainable, but what does that exactly mean? It won't be there 50 years from now? Well, so in the case of a fruit tree, 15 to 25 years is their lifespan. That's the important thing. A peach or a nectarine or a plum or an apricot, typically 20, 25 years for home gardeners, 15 to 20 years for orchard operations. So yeah, you're doing things that are going to shorten the life of the tree, but you're growing it primarily for the fruit. There are some exceptions to that that I think we should consider as we're choosing the location and the training. I think persimmons, for example, are beautiful enough to grow in their own right as the fruit as a nice, just a nice bonus. Some of the flowering peaches like the Red Baron or the Saturn peach, which have beautiful flowers, they're growing double delight nectarine, spectacular when they're in bloom. Okay, train that more like a tree, make it a focal point. Weeping Santa Rosa plum, weeping mulberries, things like that. And work with the ornamental value of the tree and prune accordingly. The rest of them, you're growing them primarily as fruit producing units in your little urban farm. Prune the heck out of them if you want to. Just be aware that each pruning cut has consequences.
Henry Mitchell says, almost any garden, if you see it at just the right moment, can be confused with paradise.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.